and knocked at my door here in California.
So can you introduce yourself?
Oh, Hassan Diab. It was a surrealistic story, put it this way.
The case will bury us all. It's just never going to go away. We're going to have this thing till the day we die.
The Kopernik Affair is a production of Canada Land in partnership with House of Many Windows. The series is written and produced by me, Alex Atak, and Dana Balut. Our editor is Julie Shapiro. Additional production by Noor Azriye. Additional research, production, and translation support by Catherine Bennett. Sound design and mixing by Resonant Fields Audio. Original music by The Tiebreakers. Our artwork is by Tony Wong. Our executive producers are Jesse Brown and Julie Shapiro. And Jesse Brown is Canada Land's publisher and editor.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the news. We will be mostly talking about Trump's shocking and totally predictable victory, as seen from Canada. Wait for that. Lisa Goldman, Europe editor at New Lines magazine. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Listeners will remember that you previously reported on Israel-Palestine for 12 years, and you were a member of the core team that founded 972 Magazine, an Israeli-Palestinian media cooperative. But now you're based in Montreal. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Lisa, I don't think that many Canadians were watching CBC News on election night. That's a great night for CNN's numbers when it comes to Canadian viewers, maybe Fox News, the big networks in the States. Our producer, James, watched CBC's coverage of the U.S. election, so we did not have to. And here's a little taste of what it sounded like.
Well, when you're in your home and you smell smoke, you look, stick your head out the window to see if your neighbor's house is burning down. So the neighbors are up to something. And so that's why, as Canadians, we care very deeply to figure out, is something on fire, Rosie?
Yeah, not yet, but that's what we're watching for.
There was a white power element to that.
Yeah, they were certainly hoping this day would be known as Rovember the 5th. We'll see. We'll see about that. With Musk's relationship with defense contracts in the U.S., but also his relationship with Russia and China and
that the Democratic Party has moved too far to the left, that they are no longer representing the vast majority of Canadians of Americans.
Interesting thought.
Same thing here.
I'll reluctantly quote John Kay here, who remarked, "Personally, I think it's adorable that CBC still thinks it should have its own little U.S. election show." Corey Morgan said, "Probably the last U.S. election the CBC will exist to cover anyway." Ouch. To watch this, it's a real stark contrast to the high production value whiz-bang graphics of the American coverage. It's just like Rosie Barton and crew sitting around a table. There was like a Democratic strategist and a Republican strategist, and if these two talking heads can't get work on American cable news on election night, I think they're not like the most in-demand pundits.
Oh, having watched the clips that you sent me, I would heartily agree.
What did you make of what you saw?
Oh, it was, okay, I will try to be judicious here. It was appalling. It was really absolutely appalling. First of all, those Dem and GOP talking heads that they had on were just, you know, blatant shills. Even when the GOP strategist spoke, and, you know, besides the fact that they were normalizing Trump, treating him as though the man actually had real policies.
He's a results-driven guy. He wants a good economy. He wants good foreign relations, no new wars. I think that's where his focus will be.
You know, the GOP guy just sort of dismissed commentary about Musk's business connections with Russia and China and said, no, he's just a great businessman. These things aren't true.
I think tens of millions of Republicans and others would say that Elon Musk single-handedly, you know, saved free speech by buying Twitter and allowing it to not be censored. So, yeah, he's a complicated guy. He's landing rockets. You know, he's an incredibly smart entrepreneur.
And there was zero pushback from the CBC people on around the table. They have to challenge him. I mean, the man was just overtly lying, and yet they just sat there and smiled benignly, let him finish his sentence, and then just moved on. There was just no pushback whatsoever. I found that quite shocking.
It was sad. The CBC coverage was sad. It's like they're performing some kind of ritual that they kind of feel beholden, and everyone kind of forgets, why do we do this tradition? What is this thing? Like, well, we can't not have election night coverage, so we know that were the last choice for most people, but some people will still show up. I think that they would defend themselves in having those voices, those strategists, because all the big American broadcasters also have absolute partisan hacks on, and something about the way that they're just constantly rotating from person to person, but then, you know, polls are closing here, and let's look at this map here, and we've got these graphics you kind of forget, but something about them just sitting around the table. The Republican goes off and just says a bunch of stuff like that, and nobody says anything. And then Aisha Mills, the Democratic shill, talks kind of just the usual stuff, Trump and white power, Trump's like Hitler.
You're talking about the propaganda campaign and the playbook of Trump. This is not new. This is not surprising. This is directly out of Hitler's playbook. This is out of an autocrat playbook.
And conservatives online are getting very mad at the CBC that that's just like, okay, yeah, here's just some yammering about how evil Trump is that there's no pushback on. I wasn't appalled that these views got aired as much as I was just depressed at the whole spectacle of it. Like, it felt like the saddest job. I've been on election night teams, you know, and I was on CBC Radio's National Election Night radio team for the 2008 U.S. presidential election. And it really was just like a duty of service. Like, we're the last place that most people are going to get their election night coverage from. But there's some truckers and people driving who just want to know what's going on. So let's just do our jobs and tell people what's going on. It still felt like we were doing it for a reason. And watching this performance on CBC, it felt like everybody would rather be at home watching CNN than covering it themselves.
That's actually such a terrible, sad indictment of our national broadcaster. When I was growing up in Canada, and again, you know, most of my perceptions of the Canadian media environment come from my childhood before I left Canada at the age of 17 and didn't come back for 33 years. During the 33 years I was absent, things really changed. You know, when I was a kid, the CBC, had a lot of gravitas. They had really smart people. Yes, it was all white men and undeniably a problem, a huge problem. We had with the Fifth Estate and we had serious news presenters and serious news analysts, and their perceptions of the U.S., their analysis of U.S. politics from the Canadian insider-outsider perspective was valuable.
It was. And you know, all respect to people like Barbara Frum, they were, for their time, they made some progress here and there. But it was very much a broadcaster of its era, but it was a serious broadcaster of its era.
That's just no longer the case. They're not offering any new insights. And you know who I turn to now for really smart analysis from an outsider's perspective is the British media. The Guardian is excellent on U.S. politics. Excellent.
Yeah. And kind of reminds us of what we once had. It almost feels like mean to keep punching at them, and who even was paying attention that night anyhow. I'm a bit more focused right now, given what happened with this election, on the months of coverage that I think gave Canadians a very different idea of what was about to happen. And what is the repercussion? What is the accountability for that? You know, Norman Spector, who's been on the show before, he posted, if media operated like other businesses, a lot of pundits and analysts on both sides of the border would be losing their jobs today. What is he talking about? Well, let's revisit some of the Kamala hype. I have to wonder, again, the media, whose job it is to tell people what is, not what they'd like things to be, how much of the desire crept into the coverage. Just looking back here, the Globe and Mail, welcome to Kamala land. In her home base of L.A., excitement for the Harris campaign is infectious. Republicans can't land a punch on Kamala Harris, wrote the Globe and Mail. Kamala Harris is pushing Bidenomics, but with feelings, and it just might work. Over at the Toronto Star, this is the real reason Kamala Harris is the nightmare candidate for Donald Trump. Kamala Harris versus Donald Trump was like watching Socrates debate Scooby-Doo. Here's CBC, as it happens in September, said Kamala Harris will win, says man with near perfect record of predicting U.S. elections. A little bit less perfect since then. Even as the Kamala hype was dying down, Globe and Mail said Kamala Harris finds the closing arguments that she needed. This was like right before election night. Globe and Mail, on the ground with Kamala Harris's campaign in Pennsylvania, I found reason to hope. You would be forgiven as a Canadian newsreader for thinking that she was a lock reading those headlines.
First of all, I want to ask seriously, did you read any of the coverage from the right-wing media in Canada, like the National Post or the Toronto Sun?
They were not Kamala fans.
Uh-huh.
I think that they were critical of her, and I was following their coverage through the months, and I read it more as them taking shots at her than the more reality-based, what are the polls actually saying?
I would say that, you know, what you're doing is you're quoting to me from Canada's, you know, most venerated media outlets, which do tend to take a liberal perspective. And I think that's because Canada's establishment is pretty much a liberal establishment. I mean, that's changing. And of course, there are pockets where that's just not true, like in Alberta. But generally, just as the U.S. establishment is mostly conservative, the Canadian establishment is mostly liberal. And I mean, small L liberal and small C conservative. So I think that the main newspapers, the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star, reflect that sort of national Weltgeist or Zeitgeist.
CBC as well.
Yeah, and the CBC. And I really don't have a big problem with that. The U.S. media was a disaster in its coverage as well. The New York Times was all off. I mean, not talking about the investigative stuff. I'm talking about the commentary and the analysis. Even Nate Silver wrote, it's a dead heat. So I have no idea who's going to win, but let me just go with my, he actually wrote, like, let me just go with my gut here. My gut says it's going to be Trump. Okay, his gut was right, but it wasn't scientific.
And he's Mr. Numbers. He's Mr. Stats, yeah.
Exactly. And so, and I think there's another factor that we have to take into account, which is the huge shock of the 2016 election results, which the polls did not predict. And I think since the 2016 elections, which the polls were just flat out wrong about, people don't trust polls.
Do you remember the slew of headlines after 2016 that this is going to be a reckoning for the media and we just, like, the media has just fallen completely out of line, not just with their audience, but with reality?
I remember very well.
That was the narrative. And if they want to have any relevance whatsoever, they're going to have to, like, really have a soul-searching moment. And I think that was true.
Then they didn't do it.
And we didn't do it. And the relevance of the media has degraded demonstrably since 2016. It's just, we will not learn that lesson. And we won't learn it. Listen to this. Here, even after it happened, here's a piece in the Star, opinion piece. One big winner of the U.S. election, Justin Trudeau. What? Here, I'll read. Team Trudeau could take inspiration from Jean Chrétien, who proved that being critical of the U.S. government, even the sitting president, can prop up your support at home. With Trump's election, Toreador Trudeau now gets to protect Canadian water, fight for dairy farmers in the coming trade negotiation, and shield Canadian women from the overarching influence of Republican legislators. It's hard to believe it was only a few days ago that a cabal of grumpy Liberal caucus members were calling for Trudeau's resignation for fear that he had no viable path to political salvation. I guess they were wrong. Matt Gurney said it. This is delusional. First of all, Trump makes Poilievre look more normal, not scary. And second, the Liberal Party is already exhausted and overstretched. Their lives just got way harder with Trump as the incoming president. The idea that this is good for Trudeau, it's magical thinking beyond C.S. Lewis magic. Like, this is not good news for Trudeau.
I would agree. It's not good news for Canada. Tariffs is very bad news, considering that the U.S. is by far Canada's biggest market. You think inflation's bad now. Wait until the tariffs start.
It's bad in very practical policy-based and economic ways, and I think it's bad for candidates like Trudeau. All right, after the break, we're going to talk about what kind of candidate on the left could possibly land a punch against a candidate like Donald Trump. Let's look forward a little bit here, Lisa. The next candidate in the U.S., the next Democrat who may actually have a hope in hell of standing up to, like, I mean, theoretically, Trump can't run again, but who knows? Whether it's Vance or Trump or a Trump-like candidate, it will not be another Kamala Harris-type figure. It will not be another polished and scripted Ivy League moderate who lectures the public about the MAGA threat to democracy. That strategy just failed miserably. Like, the big assumption that they made, and The Daily had a good piece about this, is they thought that Americans really were with them on caring about democracy and rule-based order. The next Democrat who actually can land a punch will be very different. Like, if the person in charge, if the president doesn't play by the rules, then you can't expect the underdog to say, well, I'm going to play by the rules, even if the boss doesn't, because then as a certainty, they're going to lose. And I think that's going to be true here, too. Like, after Poilievre is prime minister, which I think is more or less a lock, I'm going with my gut.
Please stop saying that. You're making me stressed.
Who are the Liberals going to put in, or the NDP, who's going to be able to land a punch? what this is going to do is open the door to loud, opinionated, rude candidates from the left. You're going to see politicians who sound a lot more like, I mean, I guess like me, which is not good for democracy. Like, this is
Jesse,
not
that's
what,
the most self-deprecating thing I've heard you say.
It's very bad. I have a number of comments, Lisa, where I'm trying to rule out even the possibility that I ever go that route, because I don't want it for myself and I don't want it for this country. And I'm not saying that I think it's going to push the left policy-wise to the left, because Trump has just proven that the policies don't matter. He won by rejecting decency and by rejecting political norms and by seeming like a legitimate, authentic voice of grievance, revenge, and anger. And I think that that's what politics is going to be, and the left is going to figure that out. So the idea that, like, this is great for people like Trudeau is a fantasy.
First of all, I don't think we know exactly why Trump won quite yet. I listened to, I'm actually really waiting for some solid analysis. The hot takes have been overwhelmingly bad. You did refer to The Daily. I find The Daily is generally very milquetoast, but they had Ested Herndon on. He's been covering
the US. Yes, that's who I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yes, I know that's who you're thinking of, because it was such a shock to finally hear somebody on The Daily express a strong, well-informed opinion with the appropriate tones of outrage.
Joe Biden's refusal to do what he implied he would do in 2020 and transition to a different type of generation, allow Democrats to have a broader conversation about change, allow Democrats to be freed from the status quo, is not what happened. I think it would be easier for me to say that Donald Trump completed this mass realignment among the working class if we had a universe where the Democrats had a primary, where the Democrats nominated a candidate that was based around some set of ideas, and it was not tied to this administration so clearly, and the status quo. But since that is not what happened, I think it has made the Republican ability to be the agents of change so much easier. The biggest thing, in my opinion, that happened was they tied themselves to an unpopular administration, and with it, the status quo.
That did not represent change.
And there was a lot of evidence that that was a bad idea.
I think that Ested Herndon has, like, proved himself just with that short clip on The Daily. He proved himself at probably one of the New York Times' most astute analysts of U.S. politics. Like, he really knows what he's talking about, and the man's on the ground. He's also a black man. Him coming out and saying, you know, that the candidate that most blacks wanted to see elected was not the right candidate, that was gutsy of him as well. And I really appreciate that. And he also said something very smart, which was that the Dems did not address the issues that were really driving voters, which were bread and butter issues, which is what they usually are. But, you know, the fact that inflation has made the cost of food more expensive since the pandemic is a very, very big deal in a country where 60% of the population lives from paycheck to paycheck. And Kamala Harris did not address that.
I think that the extent to which this was, what does your rhetoric have to do with the price of bread, was a massive factor in this.
I agree with you 100%. And that was a huge, huge, huge miss. Trump didn't address that either, but he's entertaining. He's an actor. And Trump validates people's worst instincts. You know, people say, well, you can't talk like that. That's not politically correct. And Trump said, oh, you can talk like that and you can be president.
Well, let's talk about this question of political correctness. And here I will turn to the National Post with, I think, some other false conclusions from what happened. Kelly McParland wrote, message to Democrats, cut the toxic wokeness, that this was a victory against wokeness, which is the same thing we're hearing from Rebel News. This was a global turning point against wokeness. America has rejected wokeness. I want to explore this idea that this was a battle between Trump and wokeness, and Trump won. Like, what does a woke person believe if you're quote-unquote woke? Like, if you believe that America should not be crusading around the world on, like, imperial colonial adventures and forcing its will upon other countries, that's what Trump thinks. You know, if you believe that our systems are corrupt, there's bias in our systems, they're rigged, and the rules are written by the elites to favor the elites, and so rather than play by the rules, let's burn it all down and make new systems, that is what Trump thinks. And if you don't like globalization, that's what Trump thinks. If you think that the press is not the voice of the people, and they hide behind, you know, oh, freedom of speech, press freedom, but really they're just the voice of the establishment, that is what Trump thinks. So that worldview, that philosophy has won. I think that what lost here was small c conservatism, a concept that our institutions are really important and they'll never be perfect. It's sort of like an erroneous liberal idea that we can make things utopian and perfect, and we should instead be conserving the rule of law and order and slowly making progress and trying to make a rules-based system more equitable for everybody. Like, that's what lost here.
I think you're right in saying that the rules-based system is no longer resonating with the majority of people, plurality maybe. My colleague at New Line's Danny Postel wrote a very interesting analysis of ordinary people's views on Trump and Kamala Harris. There were a lot of issues that liberal educated people don't really, they consider them already resolved in the public discourse, but for a lot of people they're not. And in the States especially, where you have this really powerful Christian evangelical, you know, white nationalist discourse that's permeated policy and the public conversation in so many states, that might be an issue that the Canadian media is not covering with much insight, based on that quote that you provided. Also, I just don't think we know what all the issues were in terms of election results.
I think there's a hopeful feeling amongst, like, progressives that this is going to push the Democrats to finally be an actual liberal option for people. And I understand that argument. My gut feeling is that this is not about policy or ideology as much as it's about anger. And the shiftability of a lot of people's votes, people who voted for Obama, who then voted for Trump again, you know, and yeah. that's younger people and racialized people are moving increasingly towards Trump. The idea that, oh, no, what the Democrats need to do is actually take much more hard positions on a lot of social justice issues. And that's going to shore this up. I don't know about that. I'm actually just completely at a loss as to what, beyond a rhetorical assault on Trump, I'm not sure what the ideology or the policy package is that takes this guy down.
There, and it seems to me, based on various sources, that people have really different, like, diverging reasons for choosing Trump. I know quite a few Arab American voters who told me, you know, they don't support Trump at all, but they just cannot bring themselves to cast their vote for the Democrats. Then I spoke with quite a few people who talked about lonely young men who really responded to Trump's machismo and dominance. Of course, white women did swing toward Trump despite the decimation of Roe versus Wade, and that seems to be a race issue. Or maybe they responded to Trump saying, I'll protect you. Or maybe they believed him when he said, look, I'm sending it back to the states. I'm not going to ban abortion, but I think that should be a state issue. And then on the Brian Lehrer show on WNYC Public Radio, some Hispanic listeners called in and said that, you know, the problem was that Hispanic working class people felt that the Democratic Party only cared about black people and that they didn't care about Hispanic working class people. These are really, in a way, conflicting points of view or conflicting reasons for voting for Trump or for choosing not to vote for Trump. But it just speaks to the Democratic Party having taken its finger way off the pulse. And I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is probably very right when she says that the party has absolutely failed to come up with a credible agenda and a set of policies that will attract working class voters. I think she's probably right about that.
Well, speaking of lonely white men, here's Pierre Poilievre. Congratulations to Donald J. Trump on his election as the 47th president of the United States. We must axe the taxes, bring home our paychecks, save our jobs, stand up for Canada.
Yeah.
Lisa, we duly note things on this program to make sure that people don't miss important stories. May I begin? I've got something here to duly note.
Yeah, please do. Please do.
We often hear about government's bloated bureaucracy, that they overpay for things, that they spend taxpayer money in ways that they shouldn't. And sometimes I glaze over at these stories, but, like, it's often because I just don't know what things cost or what they should cost. But it's a piece in the Toronto Sun that I could relate to. Federal Liberals spent nearly $2 million to produce podcasts. Access to information requests by the Canadian Taxpayers Federation revealed that the government has been making podcasts. Who knew? Lisa, are you a fan of the podcast A Sayers? Like, you know how Canadians say A? This is called A Sayers.
This is the first I've heard of it. Have you listened to it? What's it about?
Well, it's produced by Statistics Canada. So you know that this is going to be a hit.
I'm already bored.
It cost over $700,000. It had five full-time staff members.
Okay.
All right, well, I forced James to listen to A-Sayers, so let's hear a montage of some of the highlights from this StatsCan podcast release, A-Sayers.
Welcome to A-Sayers, a podcast from Statistics Canada, where we meet the people behind the data and explore the stories behind the numbers. I'm your host, Tegan Bridge.
So often when you read about productivity statistics, it's labor productivity that they're discussing. So it's gross domestic product per hour worked.
Because graphs don't translate well to podcasting, instead, the slide whistle will give you an idea of what the graph would look like.
StatsCan spokesperson Carter Mann defended this spending and said, most episodes surpass 470 downloads within the first 7 days of release, which means that A-Sayers is in the top 10% of all podcasts.
470? About
470 downloads. It costs over $700,000. I am in the wrong part of the podcasting business. Where do I find some government work here? Oh my God.
And I actually believe in big government, and I'm a big government kind of democratic socialist, but that kind of waste is pretty appalling. Duty noted.
That's our show for today. Lisa Goldman, thank you again for joining me. It's been great both times talking to you. I hope you'll come back. Where can people find you?
I write for a magazine called New Lines Magazine, newlinesmag.com. So you can scroll down to the bottom where it says staff. You'll see me with my little drawing, a little avatar and bio blurb, and you can click on it and read all the articles I've written for them. You can also find me on X, although I'm hoping to sort of move over to Blue Sky pretty soon, at Lisa NG, LISANG, same username at Blue Sky and Instagram.
Thanks again.
Thank you. Take care.
You can email me about today's show at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. This episode is produced by James Nicholson, with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production manager is Max Collins, who also did the fact-checking on this episode. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. You can listen ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Thank you.